Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Mark Diana. He is now the writer for Blood on Sunset from Source Point Press. Now join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Diana. Welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Glad to meet you.
Hey, Jeff. How are you? Glad to meet you, too.
I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure. I got to read your recent comic book, Blood on Sunset, and it was really entertaining, so thank you so much for coming.
Cool. Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, I definitely did. So I always ask the first question to the writers who I talk to. I always ask them, when did they fall in love with comic books and who were their earliest influences?
Yeah, I think I fell in love with comic books probably later than most people. Later in life, I'm 44 right now. I was in my mid 30s probably when I first fell in love with comic books. I had always, this might be sacrilege in the comic book world, but I was never really into superhero comics. And I think for a long time, that was kind of what dissuaded me from wanting to read comics. And then I read, I was talking to a friend of mine, who's a comic book writer himself, David Boer. And, I said like, look, what's a good entry point into comics? And he recommended a book called Southern Bastards, which I read and I devoured it and I just loved it. And that to me was, so I don't know when that book came out. I can't remember, but I was probably in my mid to late 30s when that came out. And that book for me sort of like opened my mind as far as what, comic books could be, let's call them independent comic books or like non-superhero comic books. Right. I remember reading it and thinking to myself, like, I didn't know you could do this in a comic book. So from that point on, I was kind of hooked, and, I really kind of went headfirst into all the indie comic books. Blood on Sunset, it's kind of a crime noir horror thing. So like, I love, like Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, their work. I love Jeff Lemire a lot. Brian K. Vaughan, all those kind of guys. But really for me, the one that kind of like lit my fire, I think, was Southern Bastards.
Well, that does make a lot of sense, because once again, having read Blood on Sunset, that is definitely a non-superhero style comic book. It is basically, it reads to me almost like the 1940, I guess, obviously where it stands, where it takes place, 1940s, 1950s, like you said, crime noir story. And it feels, it definitely moves away from the traditional big two superhero comic book.
Yeah. It's fun for most of my life. I mean, I've always loved to read and I've always loved to write, and I wrote a lot of fiction and short stories and things like that. And I used to love reading Raymond Chandler stories. The Big Sleep's one of my favorite novels. And when I first, when I was kind of like falling in love with comic books, and I'd been writing prose, and I attempted to write a novel and I finished it. It didn't ever get published or go anywhere. I still have it. But from that point on, I kind of thought like, well, if I ever did anything in comics, I'd want to do something in that sort of like Raymond Chandler-esque sort of world. I live in Los Angeles and I just love that world. And I love that style of writing. I love those movies. So there were many sort of like false starts along that way. But I think one of the things I always kind of tried to keep, and I thought maybe, I wasn't sure if it would work as an advantage or a disadvantage as far as not being so deeply embedded in the world of comic books when I started writing it, was I could come at it from kind of an outsider's perspective, and I think initially when I started, I wrote it too much like a novel, and I ended up having to throw it all out and kind of start over. And I started attempting to write it before I even really read and understood comic books, I think. So that point I was telling you about when I started reading Southern Bastards, I'd already attempted a couple versions of Blood on Sunset and just didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I read Southern Bastards. I was like, okay, I think I kind of understand. and I went back and tried it again and understood sort of the cadence and the rhythm of how a single issue works or how an entire character arc works. And then it started to come a little bit better to me, but I'm just speculating now that you mentioned this, but I wasn't sort of influenced by the big two comic book publishers or like all the superhero comics or the structure of those comics. So maybe it allowed me to be a little freer, maybe, I hope.
So when you sat down to start writing your comic book, having once again not existed in the world of comic books, how did you figure out and how did you develop your style for writing them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it was a lot of starts and stops. In other words, so I'd written a version of it, as I said. And if you ever read like The Big Sleep or any of those like
classic sort of like hard-boiled detective stories from like the 40s and 50s. They're written in a certain style, right? Like you the way the detectives talk and the way the cops talk and everybody, it's very distinctive. And when I first tried to write it, I wrote it very much like that, as I had said before, but it sounded very cliche. I mean, you've heard that, you know, Raymond Chandler invented that, right? But now everybody else is just ripping it off. So I was told by one publisher, this is just too cliche. And that kind of crushed me for about 2 months, and then I put it away and I thought about it and I restarted it. So as far as how I approached it, from that point on, I thought, well, I'm just going to approach it from the point of a character, not from the point of a genre. My main character is this guy named Clint Braddock. I wanted it to be his story. I wanted it to be a personal story. I wanted it to be set in Los Angeles in this time and place, but I didn't want it to necessarily, I was very, very concerned in a way about the genre and how it would be perceived, because this was territory that's been well-worn in books and movies. I didn't want it to just be thrown away and dismissed as another hard-boiled detective story, because it's not that. So I approached it from the perspective of this character, tried to write pretty clearly and distinctively from his perspective, his point of view. I had consulted with a lot of friends, looked online about how comic book scripts were written, because I had never actually read one before. As I mentioned, I had a good friend, David Boer. He writes a comic book called Canto.
I'm familiar with him.
Yeah, he just came out with another one called Killer Queens. So he's I've known him for years, and he was a great help and resource for me. He gave me some scripts, kind of helped me and encouraged me along the way. There were points where I wanted to quit, and he came back and said, "What happened to that story you were working on? That was good. You should keep doing that." So, but he was kind of, I would say, my mentor in as far as bringing a script and learning how to write a comic book.
Yeah, you know, I can't help but think that every indie author has that one moment where they're like knocking on their ass a little bit when someone says like, that's not how it works. And they're like, they got to figure out how to get back on their feet again, how to once again get their shit together. And, you know, it seems like there's a universal story to failure leading to success.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny because I was trying to do it, and David and I had kind of these parallel paths. And he found a publisher for his first book. It was called Powerless with Vault Comics, a little earlier than I had. And I had had that story that I told you where I'd been kind of knocked down and I'd kind of given up. And I hadn't looked at the book for a year, maybe even longer than that. David was starting to get a little momentum. And I remember we were hanging out one day, and he, like I said, he just said, "Whatever happened to Blood on Sunset? What's going on with it?" And I was like, "I don't know." And then he started talking me into it. And then I remember at that point, I just set a goal for myself. I think that was in the summer when we had that conversation. And I had said by next year, next Comic-Con, which was almost a year from then, I didn't make a goal to get it published, but I made a goal to make significant progress. In other words, like find an artist, start creating pages, get issues written. Cause I hadn't even done that. I had just kind of lost hope. I just kind of gave up. So he kind of gave me with the fire, kind of gave me a little push that I needed. And I set that goal for myself and I hit it. You know, by the next year I had an artist and we were working on pages. And then from there, we managed to get the book together.
So for our listeners, can you give them your pitch for Blood on Sunset?
Yeah, sure. So the story takes place in, as you had mentioned earlier, in LA in the late 1940s. Bugsy Siegel, the notorious gangster that we all have heard of, he's just been murdered. So in the wake of his murder, there is a mob war kind of brewing. Bugsy Siegel's organization exist, and there is another criminal organization in LA that is rising up and trying to unseat him, trying to take over his operations in the city. So we have this sort of brewing mob war. In the middle of that, we have our main character. His name is Clint Braddock. He's a former LAPD police officer who sort of unwittingly finds himself in the middle of this mob war. He's being used as a pawn by somebody. He doesn't know who or why or what any of this has to do with him. But he needs to figure it out, and pretty quickly, he learns very early in the book he's actually being framed for the murder of Bugsy Siegel. So as Braddock is endeavoring to figure out what exactly is going on, the story kind of unfolds from there. But one of the biggest revelations in the story is we have these two criminal organizations, as I had said. One of them is run by a character called Mayor Lombardo, who isn't human. He's what we call in the story, we call him Eaters, but it's actually sort of, let's call it your 1940s version of a vampire, a gangster vampire, right? So on the one hand, you have Bugsy Siegel's crew. On the other hand, you have Mayor Uppercut Lombardo's crew. And in the middle, you have Braddock. And the story kind of rolls out from there. So it's got a little bit of that crime noir. It's got a little bit of supernatural horror. It takes place, as I said, in LA. It uses a lot of real people, a lot of real locations. And when I was writing it, I did a lot of research on gangsters in 1940s Los Angeles, which is a ripe, rich world if you ever really get into it. And so I've brought in a lot of that stuff too into the story. So a lot of it is actually like based on true people and true things. Just, you know, we've thrown in vampires to make it a little more interesting. But that's the basic pitch.
So why did you choose the time period that you did? I mean, obviously, you like said, Bugs is a real guy. This really did happen. He really get killed. What was it about that moment, his death, that time period that you felt was ripe for story to tell your story?
You know, so I had read a book before I was even really thinking about writing a comic book. I'd read a book called L.A. Noir by an author named John Bunton. It's basically just like it's a nonfiction book about the history of Los Angeles, particularly about two men, Mickey Cohen, who's a pretty notorious gangster in Southern California, and Bill Parker, William Parker, who was the like sort of a legendary chief of police in the LAPD. So this book called L.A. Noir is this amazing book that details their sort of their battles over the course of like three decades. So I read that book and it starts in the 40s. And a lot of it takes place in the 40s when all these gangsters were kind of at the height of their powers. And I remember reading that just thinking like, this is just such an insanely interesting world. And it's like, a lot of it is the stuff of movies, right? It doesn't even seem real. Mm. So I'd read that book and it started to seem very interesting to me. I also lived in LA, or still do. So a lot of what I was reading took place around the corner from my house and down the street. And I knew that place and I knew that other place. So that was one influence. And then the other thing that happened that made me really want to set it in that world was, if you remember, also called L.A. Noir, there was a video game called L.A. Noir that came out roughly around the same time. I can't remember what year. I want to say maybe this was 2010, something like that. This is when I kind of first started. And they had these ads around, this is going to be a weird story, but they had these billboards around town in LA. I don't know if they were everywhere, but in Los Angeles where I live, these billboards are everywhere. And I just thought they were the coolest. They looked like comic book panels to me, these big billboards, and the art was really cool. And it had that sort of like noir sort of, obviously, I mean, that's what LA Noir was, the game. So I saw those panels. I was reading this book. The story seemed so interesting to me. I was kind of being assaulted from, by all these different influences at different times. And it just something clicked in my mind. That's like, oh, that would be a cool world to sort of inhabit and write about. And as I said earlier, my one thing was like, I didn't want to just do another sort of detective story from the 40s, because I didn't want this to really be a detective story. So I had tried to think of like, I feel like I need another element. I feel like I need to put something else in there. So I just kind of came up with this idea that I don't think I'd ever seen before, which is what if they were vampires? What would that, what would that mean? How would that change things? What would happen if that was the case? So you just kind of set up those pieces and just let them go and see what happens.
I mean, obviously it was very successful. It got picked up by Source Point Press.
Yeah.
So what led you to take it to Source Point Press? Once again, for some listeners who may not be as big into the indie scene, once again, the very up and coming publisher in the world of comic books, indie comic books. Yeah. So what did they do for you as a creator? And why were they the best home for your book?
You know, it's an interesting story. And you know, if there's anybody who's listening, who's an aspiring creator of comic books, I think it's a good lesson in perseverance, because I had submitted the book to Source Point and they rejected it. And then I went around and submitted it to everyone else I could find, and everyone else rejected it as well. I could show you the list, but I mean, there's a good 30 or 40 rejections on there. And then I managed to land it with another publisher. And long story short, that deal fell through. The publisher kind of went away, as often happens in the world of indie publishing. It wasn't like a big publisher. So I was left. And at that point we had basically finished the book. I'd finished five issues of it. I had invested a lot of money, and you know, Arjuna, who did the art, had finished the pages. They looked beautiful. So I had a finished comic book and nowhere to publish it. So I remember Source Point initially had shown a little interest. They said they liked it, but they said they had other titles that were similar. So I just went back to them. I'd like to say I you know, pitched it to them, but I would say I begged. I said, can you please take another look at this? Please take another look at it. I need, you know, I said, I have this book. It's done. We don't have a home for it. What do you think? And Josh and Jacob over there were amazing. And they're like, yeah, we'll take another look at it. And this is over the 4th of July. And, you know, within a couple of days, they're like, yeah, we may have been a little hasty in our judgments. They're like, we really like this. This is great. So what have they done for me? I mean, they've done everything for me, right? I mean, they've given the book a home. They've helped publicize the book, which is, you know, in the world of, this is also something I'm grateful to you for, because podcasts like this are super helpful, right? Oh, it's very hard to publicize books. So, you know, anything we can get is always a huge help. So SourcePoint was amazing as far as that, keeping us at home, putting the book in print, which I never in a million years thought I'd be able to hold a comic book in my hand that I wrote. So that's exciting. So the fact that it just has a home, and they've been so incredibly supportive, they've not intervened in any way, right? They've let us kind of do what we want to do. The only thing they did was they said, we want a different cover for the first issue. So I threw it back to Arjuna, the artist, and he came up with this amazing cover. I'm like, well, that was a good call. We got a much better cover out of it. So, I'm eternally grateful to those guys. They've been amazing. It's we were homeless for a long time there, and we had this book and nowhere to go, you know, so now we do.
Now, the cool thing about your story, like you said, not only is it the 1947 has to do with mobsters, but there's the vampire element as well, the eaters. Often in a lot of fictional stories, vampires are kind of used almost like allegorically within a story. What was it about the vampires that fit yours, and what were you trying to say using them?
I liked them for two reasons, because I think, as you say, vampires are often used allegorically, right? I mean, they don't often get a lot of shape as real characters with a real like emotional thrust, right? So I thought about, you know, and this wasn't something I consciously thought about beforehand, but it was something that occurred to me as I was writing it, was if you think about like gangsters, and not even just gangsters, but just criminals in general, right? Why do people become criminals? Like being a criminal or committing a crime is probably one of the most ultimately selfish acts, right? And, you know, doing something selfish is also something very human, right? I mean, that's what humans do. It's all about, I don't want to say we're all selfish, but in some ways.
No, we're pretty selfish.
We're all pretty selfish, right? Right. So it's like, so I thought like, okay, that it'd be interesting to take these characters that, as you say, are always classified as sort of monsters or symbols for something else, and put them in this very human world, doing this very human thing, committing crimes, right? Doing the things that gangsters do, trying to like unseat, you know, politicians in a major metropolitan city, like making backroom deals with the mayor, right? Buying off cops, you know, by paying for protection or having cops pay them for protection, doing all those things that to me seem like very, obviously very selfish, but very human things. So I thought it was just an interesting sort of juxtaposition. Like you put these monsters in this world where they're acting like people, they're doing the things that people do, but they have this extraordinary power that also separates them from those people. So I wouldn't sit back and say like I thought of them as symbols or allegories really for anything. I just thought it was like, maybe this is the extreme version of what humanity can become, right? When you see somebody that has too much power, too much ability, too many resources, and you unleash them on something with basically unchecked power, what can happen? And that's sort of what these eaters in our story do. There's nobody who can stop them. And as you get into the story, you realize that Braddock is the hero of the story. Clint Braddock is the guy who can stop them potentially. But he's got his own conflicts and he has to decide sort of where his loyalties lie. So that's what I liked about the vampire angle. Cause it's funny too, because it's like detectives, vampires, it's all, you know, it's been done so many times. Right. And I was very aware of that and constantly asking myself, like, how do I make this different? How do I make it interesting? What is a different approach? What's a different angle? And I don't know if it's what I've just described has been done before. I'm sure it has, but I had never seen it, so it seemed new and interesting to me.
Well, that's the important part. As long as you can make it into your voice, it's as unique and real as it needs to be.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was doing research on vampires, and in our story, you know, I'd come across these stories of vampires in you know, every not every country, but most cultures have their own version of these creatures, right, that come by night and like consume your blood or consume your essence or whatever it may be. And often, you know, I think in movies and things, we most commonly see them take on the form of bats, right? That's the sort of the classic version of what a vampire would do. But I think it was somewhere in Eastern Europe, they had this tradition of these, I don't even think they were called vampires, but they were vampire-like, and they would turn into moths, like the insect, a moth. Really? And, yeah. And I thought that was so interesting. Right. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I've never seen that before. So that's actually something that happens in our story. So our vampires, in fact, there's a whole, you know, the whole organization is peopled by these eaters, but there's one Mayor Lombardo who's sort of the head of the organization. He's the most powerful one and he can do that. He can turn into a swarm of moths. So
that's cool.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. Yeah. And Arjuna Susini, who's the artist, you know, I would write these pages and think to myself, like, I wonder what Arjuna's going to do. I can't wait to see it. And, you know, Lombardo, the character, he does it sparingly. He only does it when he really needs to or when he really needs to make a point. But there are a couple of points in the story. He just bursts into like a swarm of moths and the moths are like crawling all over the pages and they consume people almost entirely. And then the moths dissipate and the person's almost gone. There's just like a pile of guts or whatever it may be. Right. Cool. So I thought that was interesting. Again, like trying to put a different twist on it. But, you know, I mean, that was something from Eastern European lore that I stumbled upon on the internet one night, which I thought, well, let's bring that into the story. Why not? It's not me.
Well, like I said, when you're cool, like one of the coolest characters in the story, obviously, is Clint Braddock. And I don't know if it's a spoiler or not a spoiler, but he's half eater, half human, and he's also an ex-cop. So was there any fictional character that you styled him after?
No, I would say there was a non-fictional character I styled him after. William Parker, who I mentioned earlier, he was the LAPD chief of police from, I think, I don't remember the years, but for a good 30 or 40 year run. If you go down to downtown LA and you ever have to do jury duty, you go to the Parker building, which is named after him. So that'll give you an idea of like how substantial he was. Braddock was kind of based on him, actually, loosely based on him. And in fact, so I told you about that book I read, LA Noir. That book was about Mickey Cohen, the gangster, versus William Parker and their clashes over the years. Our two characters, Lombardo, is based on Mickey Cohen, and William Parker informed Clint Braddock. So I took those two real guys and kind of fictionalized them into my two versions of them. So I like the idea of sort of a hard-boiled, hardcore, old school, gritty, gnarled detective cop on the one end, and then Lombardo, the Mickey Cohen-esque character, on the other end. So he's not based on anybody fictional. He's based on a real guy. Obviously, I brought a lot of fictional components to him. Like you said, he is half human, half vampire. He is sort of the only hybrid that he's aware of, that anyone else is aware of. He doesn't even fully accept that that's what he is. And in this world, vampires have existed before and people are aware of them. It's not like it's a new thing. Nobody knows who they are. People are aware and people have ostracized them, right? And Braddock doesn't want to admit that that's what he is. But when Lombardo learns, and again, this isn't much of a spoiler, that you learn this pretty early in the story. When Lombardo learns what Braddock is, he becomes very interested in him, because somebody like that could be a tremendous weapon for him. So that's where this push and pull between Braddock, sort of, he's got this inner turmoil. He doesn't know sort of which side he belongs on. And he's constantly, in the first pages of the first issue, he's talking about he's always been sort of on two sides of the living and the dead. And that's his constant struggle, is trying to figure out where he belongs in the world.
Now, since he is a part eater, does that imply that in his past he must have done some atrocities to stay alive? I mean, vampires are, as you call them, they're eaters. So it implies he's probably eating something or someone. Is that going to be brought up somewhere in the story?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it comes up. In the second issue. We get a flashback where we learn about this. And I don't want to give too much away, but there is a point in the story where we see something that he had done, something that happened to him. He's almost kind of like, in a way, like Hulk-ish, right? Like he's got this sort of like inner monster that he's trying to keep in check. And at times it gets the best of him, and it happens a couple times throughout the story. But there was one significant event where he figured out kind of what he was. And when that happened, his life spiraled out of control. And I say he was a former cop, and that was when he was kicked off the police force and he became a private detective, kind of circling the drain, barely holding on at the bottom of society. And that's where we find him at the beginning of the first book. So some things have happened to him. He's down on his luck. He's as low as he's going to be. And then he gets pulled into this mob war. But yeah, he's got a pass. And I think as the story rolls out, I'm writing the second arc now. We explore a little bit more of his past, and I've thought, I don't know how long this will go. God willing, we'll get to do a lot more of them if people like him. But I've always thought it'd be cool to do some prequels and talk about sort of his past before that, because I think it can be really interesting, because he's a very he's a very conflicted character, and I think he's got an interesting past that I'd like to get into.
Now, there's another character in the book that's very interesting as well. The ghost that follows around Braddock. Now, yeah. Who is he, and when will readers get to learn his backstory?
It's funny you would ask that right after the previous question, because he's involved in that. Right, so there's a character named Tommy Geiger, who's kind of like, as you say, a ghost who kind of, he also sort of functions as Braddock's, like, I don't want to say his conscious, it's not quite that black and white, but he kind of shows up at the most annoying of times, and really just sort of is constantly just sort of badgering. He's kind of Braddock's mental anguish made manifest, right? So we can kind of see and hear and understand what Braddock's thinking. He is involved in the incident that I talked about that I don't want to give too much away about. But yes, we learn quite a bit of his backstory in the second issue as well, because he is kind of a confusing, not confusing, but let's say like intriguing presence in the first book. And like, oh, who is this guy? What is he doing? And then we find out where he came from and what he was. But yeah, he's sort of a walking, talking, living, or not living, but a walking, talking example of Braddock's internal conflict in his checkered past, basically.
So he is legitimately real. He's not sort of like a weird delusion that Braddock's having.
No, I think of him as more of a weird delusion that Braddock is having.
Okay.
He was a real person at a point, but something happened between him and Braddock is haunted by him. Let's just put it that way. He's kind of a reminder of who Braddock really is. You know, like I like to think that over the course of the story, Braddock is putting on this air that he's a normal person just like everybody else. And he's got this voice always kind of over his shoulder, whispering in his ear, reminding him, you're not like everybody else. You're different. You've got a dark side. You've done some things. And now more things are going on. And I think one of the interesting things about Braddock is I wanted to make him very flawed. So as the story is rolling out, he's constantly in denial about a lot of things. And there's another character called Beverly Hills that we should talk about in a second, but she's involved in this too. And Braddock is very much in denial about things, and he can't see things that I think the reader can probably see. And that's where Geiger the ghost comes in, because Geiger is the one who kind of like occasionally prods him and reminds him, like, hey, don't forget about this. Or like, I know what you're really doing. I know what you're really up to. Why don't you admit it? Just go ahead and admit what you are, admit who you are, admit what you're thinking, right? He's like that voice. But he was a real person that was involved in Braddock's past and has now come back to sort of like haunt him.
Well, you know, just so happened that my next question was about Beverly, who, you know, seemingly that, you know, classic femme fatale kind of character. And obviously she has a history with Braddock. Now, is that history more of a help or a liability to Braddock?
Oh, I would say it's a huge liability for him. So there's this character named Beverly Hills, and believe it or not, she's based on a real person who is also named Beverly Hills, if you can believe that.
Is that the real name?
No, I don't think it was a real name. No, she was. I know. I wish
like
it was.
It's like a porn stripper name.
Well, you know, that's what she was. She was a burlesque dancer, the real Beverly Hills in the 40s in LA. She was an interesting person, and she actually got involved in real life with the real Mickey Cohen, and they were engaged to be married at some point. And then they broke it off, and she kind of disappears into the pages of history. But I always loved the name, and I remember thinking, like, there's gotta be a character named Beverly Hills. So there is a character named Beverly, Beverly Hills, and she is a massive liability for Braddock, and they were a couple. They were an item at one point, and they no longer are. And that is still, he still pines for her, and he's still clouded by his obsession with her and for her. So because of her presence, that is when I said earlier that he's flawed and he can't see things often for what they are. It's often because of her. And she, you know, we'd also said that Braddock has the secret. He's half human and half eater. And really the only other person who knows his secret is her, because they were together when the incident happened that sort of revealed who he is. So, so she knows his secret, in other words, and that's a huge liability for him.
Mm. So is Blood on Sunset a miniseries or ongoing? And you said you already completed five of them so far, five issues?
Yeah, we've completed five issues. First one, issue number one, comes out in 3 days. It comes out on the 29th. I don't know when this is going to be posted, but comes out on December 29th, and there are five issues in that first arc. Ultimately, we're going to do three arcs. So it's an ongoing series, I guess, in that sense. I think hopefully there'll be 15 issues by the time we're done. But this is the first arc. And as I said, you know, this is that mob war kind of brewing. And in the second arc, if we get to do it, which I hope we do, that's when the mob war really comes to fruition. And that's when some of these secondary characters kind of rise up and things get a lot more interesting.
Well, that's very cool. Like I said, Blown on Sunset, it was a very fun read. I luckily got a preview copy, so I got to enjoy it ahead of time. Is there anything else you're working on as well, or as you work on Blood on Sunset, another series or anything?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've been kind of toying around with another series, and I'm hoping we can start pitching actually in the new year. It's just about ready to start pitching. It's a sci-fi mm-hmm. series called Derelict, and Vittorio Estone, who did the color for Blood on Sunset, he did the art for this new book called Derelict. So. So that's going. I'm excited about that one. We've got 10 nice pitch pages ready to go. We're just finishing up the cover now, which looks really cool. It's exciting. So I'm hoping Blood on Sunset, you know, gets a little traction and that it does some good things, and then we get to make Derelict down the road and maybe make more Blood on Sunset issues. It'd be fun.
Well, very cool. It was a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Deanna. Thank you so much. And Blood on Sunset, you said it comes out this Wednesday. And then with the next one, I assume it's going to be a month after that.
Yeah, every month for the next 5 months, starting December 29th. So check them out. You can pre-order them. You can go into your comic book shop, demand that they carry it on their shelves, and then pick up a copy. I'd be very excited.
Well, thank you so much, sir. It was a pleasure to talk with you. I want to have a very good night, and hopefully our listeners will pick up Blood on Sunset.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
Mine as well. Have a very good night.
You too. Take care.
You too.